Thank you for joining us today for Volume 2 of our artist interview series, Articulations. This program is a collaboration between the Margaret Sless Center for Women and Gender Equity and KHOI-FM. My name is Nancy Gebhardt, and we are thrilled to introduce you to five amazing artists in our community, from whom you'll hear every Monday at 4 p.m. during the month of October. This is the final interview in this volume of the series, and I'm excited to be speaking with Tanvi Rastogi. Tanvi is a former public librarian whose main area of focus was creating community spaces in which young people with marginalized identities were represented and validated and could find safe outlets for self-expression and exploration. She began painting in 2019 as a form of distraction and stress relief and primarily works with watercolor and pen or acrylic and Sharpie. In the years since she began painting, Tanvi has amassed a large collection of portraits of her partner Chris, as well as portraits of other Ames locals. Tanvi holds degrees in sociology and information science from Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Welcome, Tanvi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So I know your bio says you started painting in 2019, and I do want to talk about your portraits a little later on in the interview. But as speaking as a member of the Ames community, I've considered you part of the Ames art community for a really long time because of the public programming you do and how they've always felt to be just infused with creativity and various types of arts, whatever the program may be. And so I want to start just by talking about one of my favorite programs that you produced, and that was the All Ages Drag Show. I know this program's no longer hosted, but can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah. So I love that it's one of your favorite programs because it was one of my favorite programs too. It was always just the most joyful, celebratory, fun time. And I don't know how many you came to, but it always amazed me how packed the room was.
I was always standing in the back. I don't think I ever had a seat. I probably came to three and I would leave and my cheeks would hurt, right? It was the
people
best.
People would cry. Yeah, like people would like actually literally cry. So the All Ages Drag Show. Before I talk about that specifically, I think I want to talk about public libraries more generally.
Sure.
And preface with that first. So public libraries are meant to be spaces of exploration and knowledge and information and community, and there are these spaces where people can gather and learn about themselves but also learn about each other. Mm-hmm. and see that they're not alone in the community at large, and that is a big job. And it's a really it requires a lot of active effort. You know, it's a lot more than should we put out a book display. Should we put out signage? Because mm-hmm. Those aren't the things that bring people in the door. And those aren't the things that people need in order to find community with other people. Mm-hmm. And so a big part of my job working with teenagers in particular was just listening to them. Like they would literally, they would come in and they'd spend like 3 or 4 or 5 hours with me. And unlike in an educational, like a school space, I'm not talking to them. They're talking to me.
Yeah.
Like just lots of talking.
Well, I can say as a parent of a teenager who spent a lot of time in your space, you were such an important and still are such an important person to him because he felt so safe and welcomed and seen just by you, right?
That
he could come in and he could tell you absolutely anything and it would be completely non-judgment.
And so you have all these kids coming in and I'm just listening, right? Mm-hmm. Like listening for what it is, what do they need in this moment right now? And so it must have been about five or six years ago, kids were talking a lot about drag because mm-hmm. RuPaul's Drag Show was really popular and they were really into it. And so they're telling me like, this is so cool and I would love to go see this, but there are no spaces for them to be able to do that. And so I hear them saying, this sounds really cool. But what I also hear them saying, not through their words, but like I hear them saying like, there's no space for me mm-hmm. in this community for me to explore this interest. No one is creating this opportunity for me to engage in some exploration about my identity, mm-hmm. To pursue this passion, to see other people or find other people that are interested in the same things, and to be empowered, and to find like positive adult role models who show you like all of the different ways that a life can look, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really, that's a big thing. It's a big thing to be lacking in your life.
Yeah.
And so I worked with my very good friend, Andra Castle, mm-hmm. Who is just a master at networking and event coordination, and really had their feet in this world already of drag. And so we worked together to put together this event that featured both drag performances by like professional artists, but then also gave kids the opportunity to perform as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what I was expecting. You know, a lot of people were not happy, but like the room was packed, and like just the costuming and the makeup and the hair and the performance, I mean, all of it coming together, it was like having Beyonce in the room, right?
Sure.
Like people think it was really like sinister, deviant thing, right? But it was so wholesome.
It was.
And like you have all these kids and they're dancing, and like people did performances to Baby Shark was one, right? And like Lady Gaga.
I remember someone came Frozen. Out as Miss Frizzle from the Magic School.
Yes, right? And it's so joyful.
Yeah.
And it really gave, you know, kids and families and people of all ages really the opportunity to see just this other form of gender expression, which was really cool. I had so much incredible feedback. Like I had one kid who she told me actually just this past year that her family went because her mom didn't understand what it was. She mm-hmm. thought it was just this like dance performance. And then they get there and she's like, what is happening right now? And she said that then opened the door for all of these conversations with her mom about gender identity. Mm-hmm. I had a kid who came in maybe a month or two after the very first one. They were really shy, really trying not to call attention to themselves. It was a trans kid. And so I struck up conversation with them because they had this super cool outfit and, mm-hmm. and just trying to like kind of pull them in a little bit. And they told me that they had never come to the library before because they didn't know if it was going to be safe for them. They didn't know how they would be treated by staff. Mm-hmm. And then they came to the show because one of their friends dragged them along. And this kid became like a regular library user.
Yeah.
They ended up becoming a volunteer. I ended up writing a college letter of recommendation for them. And so, you know, it's about creating this space, but then it's also opening this door to the library itself, which then opens a million other doors as well, right? I it's one of my favorites.
It's such a wonderful program. It was such a great, like I said, my cheeks hurt because it was so joyful, right? Like you never stopped smiling and it felt so celebratory and beautiful to be in that space mm-hmm. with people. And I love how you described, you said, you know, I didn't know what I was expecting. And I can imagine as someone who has organized lots mm-hmm. of programs and events that you can't anticipate that response, right? You really can't. And so it feels so authentic and so really wonderful to be in that space.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember one time talking with Andra, actually, mm-hmm. as they were describing, I don't remember exactly how the conversation went, but the conversation was about false eyelashes.
Yeah.
And they talked about a time preparing for the All Ages drag show where they just like went along the line and like applied eyelashes on a number of performers.
And like that's the thing, right? Like you're showing kids like these things are okay.
Yeah.
Right. It's just that act of validation.
Yeah. One thing that I really liked about the program was that it was all ages and all were welcome mm-hmm. for the beginning, right? And then, you know, and then you would kick people out, right? Then the grown-ups were kicked out. It became teens only kind of space for the second part. And as much as I hated that I had to miss that second part, I thought that was such a wonderful and beautiful intentional organization of that program. Can you talk a little bit more about why that was important?
So you know, whenever I would do programming, it was always just for teenagers. And that's just sort of the way the library sets it up. And basically it's just for the very simple reason of you're giving these kids the space to express themselves in a way where they don't necessarily feel pressure or judgment from other adults, right? So there'd always be adult supervision, yeah. but it's like, you, like if your parents are in the room, like what things are you not necessarily saying or expressing? Because it's just a little bit uncomfortable. And so for the Ologies drag show, the kids had then had the opportunity to do a Q&A with all of the professional performers, which is really cool. And they would ask some like pretty personal things sometimes, like mm-hmm. how would you handle telling your family that this was something that you were really interested in doing? Mm-hmm. You know, what do you say to people who think that there is something really gross about? And I don't know that sort of questioning and truth telling could happen in a big, you know, a big group where there's 200 people and there's like crying babies and then also grandmas. And you know, it's it just created a much more honest and safe space for them to be able to have those conversations with the performers. And then they just got to hang out with other teenagers. Right? Yeah. And like, that's just more fun.
Absolutely. No, I think I thought it was, I've never had the chance to talk to you about kind of that decision, but I always loved that moment when I would get kicked out, because I thought that was such a great thing to be so intentional about, that not everything has to be for everybody.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Like,
yes.
You don't always have to be invited to the party. Like, it's okay. Yeah. Right? Like, that it's that space was specifically for the teens in that moment. And I thought that was wonderful. So we talked about how joyful it was. Obviously, it was also met with some resistance, mm-hmm. Some very organized resistance. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give that a lot of time on the air, because that's not what the program was at all. But my question is, when organizing programs like that for these teens and recognizing the need for this in the community, how do you persist in that work mm-hmm. in the face of that resistance?
So I actually have a kind of a longer response to this,
sure.
if you're willing to spend the time
Absolutely.
On it.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I have a pretty deep library philosophy, and a lot of it is actually like guided and inspired by my mom. So mm-hmm. my mom came to this country when she was in her mid-20s. So she was an adult. She didn't speak any English. She lived here for 4 decades as a single parent, because my father passed away when I was really young. And it was a pretty hostile experience for her living mm-hmm. here. So even though she was here for so many decades, she was always considered an outsider. She never really was able to find community. And growing up, that was really hard for me, because she felt like a very vulnerable person. And it's mm-hmm. hard when you're a kid to see the person who's meant to be protecting you be vulnerable, just in the way that people would treat her. And then I felt like I needed to protect her.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do that because I was a child. And so I always wondered, you know, how would her experience in this country have been different if she had just been more welcomed? And she ended up leaving. So mm-hmm. she moved back home to India several years ago. And that's hard too, because now my mom lives on the other side of the world, right? Mm-hmm. So it's had this massive effect on our family. And so everything that I do is to sort of honor just honor her and that experience. And like, if I couldn't protect her, how can I look out for other people and make sure that they don't have that same experience, and make sure that they are able to find the community that they need?
Yeah.
And then the other part of it is just working with kids, right? So, you know, to go back to my mom, how could I make sure that if kids were going to be leaving this community, it was because they really wanted to, because they had some interest in the wider world or some opportunity, and not because they felt like their well-being depended on getting out.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, you're working with these kids, and, you know, you can see that, you can see when they feel isolated, you can see when they feel excluded, or when they feel like they need to hide something of themselves because someone has told them that it's not okay, or just like the larger culture around us is telling them that it's not okay. And then you see what happens when you give them what they need, and it's so joyful, right? Mm-hmm. It's like life-giving.
Yeah.
And so you can't look at that, at these people who are like literally right in front of you mm-hmm. and think, this is too hard. Like, I'm gonna back out now.
Yeah.
And so you just keep going.
Yeah.
And I'll say that with the caveat that like, it's not the same 6 years ago as it would be today.
Sure.
It was hard back then. But I think that our culture has just evolved in a very significant way to be even more inflammatory and more the efforts to prevent you know, inclusive programming and education are a lot more organized now.
Mm-hmm. Which is making, I think, right, the experience of what you're saying is people not feeling that they have this place or sense feeling of welcoming or belonging in a community. It's making that, increasing that feeling, mm-hmm. as well as increasing the difficulty in creating those spaces and creating those programs to kind of counteract that feeling.
I will say that, like, there's a cost to doing the work, right? You risk your own comfort, right? Mm-hmm. For one, relationships, the way that people in your community see you, you know, possibly tension in your workplace. But there's risks to not do it. There's cost to not doing it as well. And I'm really lucky, you know, now as an adult that I feel like I am in a position where the calculation is in my favor to just do it. And when you have such like a driving force behind you, like I do, just thinking about my mom all the time, it's just imperative. Like you just don't back down.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that story about your mom and her experience and your experience too, right? In that house and in that space, especially what that meant for you as a child, as a teenager, right? And how that impacted the way you approach your work, because, and it I think it shows up, right? Even if people had seen the work that you do but didn't know that story, they could kind of see that connection in how important it is for you to create welcoming, inclusive community spaces that are not, you know, they're not, there are things outside people's homes, right? Yep. Because maybe the home's not the welcoming place that it needs to be for some youth, and outside of the schools, which we know are not well suited for all youth and for all kids. And so I think all of that, it's so beautiful to see how that kind of came together in public programming.
Yeah.
Right. And that was deeply informed by listening, right? And listening to kids and saying, like, what is it that you need?
Yeah. And trying to keep them safe, right?
Yeah.
So, like, one of the other things, too, is like, it's hard to back down. And you do keep persisting because they're looking to you now, right?
Yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, you have said, I'm creating this space for you. And once you say it and once you make it happen, I mean, what does that do to them if you say, you know what, actually, we're not going to do this now.
Yeah.
And really, it was a matter of, are they physically safe? And I never felt like they were ever going to be in a situation where they weren't physically safe. And then secondary to that, then, is their emotional safety, right? And if there are going to be people who are loud and bigoted, then I need to be just as loud back.
Yeah.
And make sure that they see that someone is standing up for them.
Yeah. Thank you for doing that and for continuing to do it, right? Not just with the work that you did at the library, but then the ways that you still maintain those relationships that you built at the library, knowing that personally, but also seeing how you do that in a lot of different spaces. Our community is much better for all of that.
That's
our kids are so well cared for by you, and I really appreciate that. So we talked about it a little bit, just about how and why you prioritize youth, right? And this idea of helping them have these spaces where they feel safe, where they can be heard, where also it goes beyond that, I think, too, in what you're talking about, because it's not just words, it's also action. You're like, I hear you and I'm going to do something with what I hear, as opposed to kind of stopping at the words. And I think those things are really important. And I can imagine in the lives of youth, that's really transformative, because just giving them a space to talk isn't enough, right? There has to be something that comes next.
So
I was gonna say, like, we kind of talked about a lot of this, but you mentioned quickly how things might be different 6 years ago as they are now. I'm just curious if you have anything more to say about how policy decisions about identities and and other kind of just like social issues, how that is affecting youth, and potentially even thinking about your kind of taking advantage of your expertise here, like for people listening who may want to start organizing inclusive spaces or opportunities or programs for youth. What are the kind of new challenges you see that will come up in doing that?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that it's so much more organized now, right? Yeah. And you see this a lot in schools and public libraries where with book challenges in particular, right? We just had this massive wave of book challenges, far more this year than there have ever been in the past. And I think what's happening now is that you just have these very large, well-funded organizations saying, these are the things that are in your community that you need to look out for. And then, you know, people are sort of whipped up into this frenzy and they go out and they're not even looking at what they're challenging. They're just going through a list and they're like, does my school or public library have this book? Yes, 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 right? And then it's just a blanket challenge. And I think that there is a really strong connection between all of these sorts of programming and collection challenges and curricula challenges and policy, right? I think they go hand in hand because you have all of these identities and experiences that are being demonized, that there is something dangerous about them. Mm-hmm. And so people look at these books and they see all these challenges and they say, this is dangerous. And because it's dangerous, then we need to create legislation to protect people, protect children from these people, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have this legislation where you're sort of denying people their rights. And then people see this legislation and they say, oh, this is happening because these people are dangerous. And therefore, we should not have materials in our public schools and libraries that are representative of those people, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's just all very circular. Mm-hmm. And it's scary. And, you know, there's so many stories now of public libraries trying to do programming for different marginalized communities. And people show up with, like, guns, mm-hmm. right? And, like, yeah. That was not something that I ever felt that I needed to worry about. And, you know, if I were to do it again now, I don't know. Like, yeah. And then how do you keep people safe? And, and then I think that leads into its, like, own version of self-censorship and soft censorship, where then you have these you know, educators and librarians who are like, let's keep away from that, partly because maybe I don't want to take the professional risk, but maybe also because I'm actually trying to keep people safe. And that's terrible. That's a hard position to be in.
Absolutely. And it comes at such a loss to the community for a number of reasons. But again, even as you were mentioning earlier, one of the first questions you have to ask, right, is about, are the kids safe in that space, right? And so if the answer is ever going to be no, you have to rethink it. But but again, the dangers of not doing anything also still exist. So it's a difficult thing. But I think to kind of go back to the more positive part of all of this is, I think for me, I think in the youth is where the hope
It
lies,
is,
right?
Yes. I actually wrote that in my notes.
Did
Like, they make me feel so hopeful, right? We live in such a hard time, and yet I see kids left and right, like, they're just challenging everything.
Yeah.
Like, they're challenging these really arbitrary rules that we live by and these really arbitrary social norms. And, like, that's so cool. They're so cool.
I think I texted that to a friend the other day. I was like, I love this generation of activists. Right? Because just because of their audaciousness. Right? And, I find it that's definitely where the hope lies. And so I think that's always a place to go back to, especially as you continue to do youth work. But I think this is a good time also to pivot and talk about your art practice, your visual art practice, because you did describe that it came as a form of stress relief, which I think can kind of, you can have already illuminated a little bit of the tension and the stress that comes with doing some of the work that you do. So can you talk to us a little bit about, like, what made you pick up the pen or the brush or whatever it was that first time?
It was literally that. I was stressed. I was just stressed out all the time. You know, and it felt really good to be doing the work I was doing. but you need a lot of support to be able to do that. And I didn't necessarily always feel like I had that support. Yeah. And then just working with teenagers is hard, right? Like I was working with a lot of kids who were really lacking in opportunity. They had a lot of struggles, and I would literally go home crying so many nights for my job. And that's
even if you do have strong boundaries, that's still a lot to take
in.
It's
a lot. Yeah.
It's a lot to take in.
I had gone to a live model drawing class that was at DG's several years ago. And I wasn't expecting to participate. I was just going to get a drink and, support my friend who is there as a model. And someone stuck a pen and a paper in my hand. And I was like, all right, I'll do this. And I loved it. It was so great. And the cool thing about it was that because it was this blind contour, I wasn't actually looking down at my paper. I didn't have to worry about it being perfect, because that was the big roadblock to doing art was it has to be perfect, right?
Yeah.
Suddenly then I found this way to enjoy art in a way where I didn't feel pressure.
Sure.
And so I just started doing it all the time. I would go home and literally just 20 minutes.
Yeah.
20 minutes a night. And then
you said the first time it was a blind contour drawing, which, so for people listening that maybe don't know, can you explain what that
practices? So basically, I was looking at the model and I was drawing what I saw without really ever looking down at the paper.
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes I struggle with perfectionism and I want what's in my head to be what's on the paper. But because I wasn't looking at the paper, it didn't really matter what came out.
And the activity itself gives you permission to let go of that perfection.
Yeah,
right? Because nobody's looks perfect when you're not looking at it.
And then you're having a drink and it's what? How is that going to affect it? So I just started doing that. And then the portraits just got bigger and bigger and bigger until they were massive. And that was it.
And so you started with the live model, right? And but then you kind of continued only doing portraits.
Yes.
Right? What is it about portraits that you're drawn to?
I like people's faces. Yeah. I find people really, really interesting. I think you can't have a sociology and an information background without finding people interesting. But I'm very much not actually a people person. I love stories. I love that drawing these portraits is a way to be really intimate with people and spend a lot of time really 20 hours or something with a single person without actually having to interact with anyone.
With their face, right?
So it's, I'm a pretty solitary person. It was just a really solitary, act, but still an act of love because I was painting people that I love. And so is sort of just its own form of interaction, I guess.
Yeah. Does your partner ever get a little self-conscious about all the pictures of him?
He is not a self-conscious person. Yeah. But he does think it's funny that he can look around our house and be that's me, that's me, that's me, that's me. It's just all these versions of him staring at him. Yeah.
As someone who studies portraiture, mm-hmm. I find portraits fascinating, right? Because I think that they give us an image of somebody who maybe, and even of that person, part of it's recognizable, but then part of it's not, right? Yeah. Because there's just different things that can be emphasized, different things that can be brought out or kind of fade into the background a little bit, just depending on the day, right? Yeah. Depending on the mood, depending on so many different factors that influence kind of how we see the world. And I think portraits are such a wonderful way of capturing people and our interpretations of people, recognizing that they're not perfect, right? Yes. That they're not this ideal representation, right. This ideal image you're trying to come to. It's this interpretation of what you see. And I think seeing yours, I saw a number of yours mm-hmm. in the collection on exhibit at Dog-Eared Books. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one thing that stands out, I think that connects back to our earlier conversation, is that they all felt joyful.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
I knew a few of the people. I knew mm-hmm. a few of the portrait sitters. And I felt knowing them, you captured their spirit, right? You captured, and they're also just joyful people. But all of them, even the portraits that I didn't know the sitter, there was so much joy in the colors, the lines, right? The way that their image was captured. And so I hope that, I don't know if that was like you went into it thinking I'm going to make me just like look joyful, but it definitely came out that way.
I love color, yeah. Which is funny because I always wear black. But I grew up in a house that was pretty devoid of any art. Like mm-hmm. my mom, everything in our house was just practical and we didn't have a lot of money. So we didn't spend money on things that we didn't need. And I always thought like when I grow up, my house is going to be full. It's going to be full of art. It's going to be full of color. And it is. We've run out of space on our walls for all of our artwork. And so it's really fun for me to be able to just put as much color as I can into that.
So you said you didn't have a lot of art in your mm-hmm. home. So that wasn't kind of an inspiration for this. But maybe it was in like trying to create the counter, right? Creating the counter by adding all of this color. But then I guess my question is like, how do you choose the people that you're choosing to create a portrait of, right? Like, what is it that draws you to them? Like, what is it? Can you describe, I guess, maybe your process a little bit more?
Yeah.
Like, what is it that you're looking for then, like, to bring into the portrait?
Just people whose faces I find really interesting, but also whose personalities I find really interesting as well. It sort of has to go hand in hand.
Okay.
So I had mentioned to you that I don't really like painting children because their faces are so smooth, which like good for them. Right?
Yeah.
Like I wish my face looked like that, but I really love like crevices and like, you know, one of the paintings that I did was a Mara Spooner, and Mara has this adorable little gap in her two front teeth. Like, so just things that are like really interesting about mm-hmm. a face, that I really, really like. I started with my husband, Chris, because I didn't feel pressure.
Sure.
Like he wasn't going to care how it came out. And then I realized that all of the people that followed, it was sort of the same thing. Like I knew that they were going to love it regardless. I knew that, you know, I could put my care for them into this piece and that's what they would see was just the care.
Did it feel different than when you shared it in such a public way where you don't, you don't have access to who's going to see it or how they're going to take it?
Yeah, I resisted for a very long time. Yeah. My friend Ben, who's like just a very supportive and encouraging friend, he was the one who was always like, put him out, like let people see him. But that was scary for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine. That's a completely different experience, right? Than making something for your own stress relief, for your own home, right?
Because I didn't think of it as like capital A art,
yes.
right? Like it was just a project. It was just something I just needed to do.
Yeah. Are you still painting
no.
or drawing?
No.
Okay.
No.
Why not?
Because art was my form of stress relief when I was in the library world. And now that I'm no longer in the library world, I have just gravitated back towards books, which mm-hmm. was like my first love. For, you know, most of my career before I moved to Ames, reading was breathing for me. Like it was life. And I really lost that. Living here in Iowa, and over the past year or so I have like rediscovered that love, and it's everything for me just to be able to have a book in my hands. And it's sort of like art too, right?
Because
it's just another, they're all just forms of storytelling. And so I'm really happy that I didn't stop making art because I felt like I couldn't do it anymore. It's just because I just found something else that I loved.
I love that, right? And that it's all about timing, and it's all about kind of like what brings you joy when and where. And I think being able to do something and let it go is a really beautiful
it
thing.
It is, yes, right? Yeah. It served a purpose for a time, and then I didn't need it, and maybe someday I will again. But
absolutely. So one thing that I really admire in the current work you're doing is the Good Trouble Youth Book Club that you've started. Good Trouble, I'm assuming, taking its inspiration from the former representative John Lewis, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. In the title. Can you tell us more about the Good Trouble Book Club?
So Good Trouble is like my pride and joy. It's my baby. I like love it more than anything else. So Good Trouble is a book club that I host at Dogger Books here in town. And it's a book club for middle schoolers that focuses on books that all have a social justice theme. And so in the stories that we read, there's always some like situation or conflict that arises based on some injustice that has occurred. And because these are things that the kids that are in the book club will likely encounter in real life, the book club provides this really great opportunity for them to practice. Like, how will you respond when this happens? Because it will happen at some point, and you need to be ready, right? Allyship and using your voice is really hard. This really stems from an incident that I had a number of years ago here in Ames. When I was at the public library, I used to go to the schools and I used to do book talks. And one year I took up just a bunch of books, and one of the books had a queer kid as the main character, and I didn't think twice about it because who thinks twice about that? And I presented the book to a class, and the kids were really, they had a really negative response to that. And they're like, oh, that's so gross. And it was like, what do I do? Like, what do I do in this moment? And I felt like, well, I'm the visitor, I'm the guest, I'm not the person in charge. And I waited for there to be some reaction. And there wasn't. There wasn't from any adult in the room. And I felt so terrible about that moment. And I would go home and I would think about it. And like every morning when I was showering, I would replay that moment in my head and be like, what if I had said this? Or what if I had said that? And I was beating myself up over it until I realized, like, oh my God, I'm giving myself the answer. Like, now I know what to do because I've practiced it so many times.
Yeah.
And inevitably, like, it ended up happening again. And I had a response for the kids. And I was able to correct it. And I was able to stand up for any queer kids who happened to be in the class, or just to show, you know, kids that it wasn't their response wasn't acceptable.
Yeah.
And so that's the point of the book club, is like helping kids develop the skills that they need to use their voice so that they're ready in the moment that they need to use it. Because that's a really hard thing to learn how to do.
That is. And just like you said, giving them the practice where sometimes just saying it out loud the first time, right? And in a space that is safe, where you can be vulnerable, where you won't be judged, where people will maybe workshop it with you a little bit.
Like, maybe that's exactly, say it this way. That's exactly what happens. So we actually just had a session this past Saturday, and we read a book called Yusuf Azim Is Not a Hero. It's about a kid who's Muslim, and it's based really heavily on an incident in 2015 in Texas where a Muslim 14-year-old kid was arrested and suspended for bringing his engineering project to school because he had made a clock and teachers thought it was a bomb. And so there's two things that happen in the book. One kid shoves a Muslim kid and tells them to go back to the country they came from. And then later in the book, a kid rips off a Muslim girl's hijab in the hallway. And so it's like, here it is. Like, here's your two scenarios. Like, close your eyes. You're in the hallway with these kids. What do we do? And like, they just had a whole array of responses. Some of them, which were pretty bad, right? Yeah. And so we were able to talk through, like, why is that maybe not helpful? Who's being centered in this action that you're taking? You know, what are the risks that you're taking on yourself? And these are all really important things to think about that you wouldn't necessarily be able to think through quick in the moment.
Absolutely. And all goes back to, you mentioned it briefly at the beginning of this part of the conversation, but about allyship, right? And giving them the tools and the skills in order to be allies in those moments. And I think that's a beautiful outcome of the Good Trouble book club. I think could be, again, because it takes, because it makes it actionable, right? It gives you this like toolbox, right? These words that you know work, you know, these, a place to start with taking action. And I can imagine too, like the all ages drag show, that the youth in the Good Trouble book club are going home and talking to their parents about the things that they're talking about, or they're maybe extending the conversation in places that they maybe aren't.
So they're actually going to be getting together sometime before the end of the year, and they're going to create a zine, and it's like how to stand up for other people. That's all you're going to tell, because that's a bad title. but it's basically going to be that, like, you know, when something is happening, how can, what are all the options that you have? How can you respond? And I think that's, the purpose of the zine is basically to get them to write it on paper and practice it in that way. But then they can give it to other people, and other people will be like, oh, these are things I could do too.
So I love that.
Dual purpose.
Yes, I love that. And it's the combination of like a visual art object and a literary object, right? In the form of a zine, which is super cool. So if young people want to get involved in the program, how do they do that?
So it's all by registration. I would love to have every single kid in the world come, but you hit a certain point and it's just too many kids. So there is a registration form on the Dogeared website. So you just go to book clubs and you find Good Trouble. Books are free. Okay. So we're really lucky that we have people around the community who are willing to sponsor each month, which we didn't ask people to. A woman just came in one day and she's like, "This is really cool. I don't have kids. Can I buy their books?"
That's awesome. Like,
I think so. That's actually fantastic. So the books are no charge to the kids.
That's wonderful.
They register, they get their book.
And attendance is also no charge. Like there's, so it's free to participate.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
And yeah, obviously space limitations. Yeah. And then also just to build an environment that you're needing to, or cultivate the environment of conversation that you're needing to. There do have to be restrictions on size and number of people.
Yeah.
But that's great that you've got that community support too. So where do you see the program going or growing?
So fingers crossed. I have like the world's best boss. Her name is Amanda Lepper at Dogeared Books. She's one of the co-owners. And I had mentioned to her one day that I would love for there to be other chapters around the country. And I was like, I could just put together a Google Doc and like people could access these resources. And she was like, no, that's not enough. So she's helping
me. And don't give away your labor for free necessarily. Right,
So she's helping me put together what hopefully will become a nonprofit within the next year. So hopefully hoping to launch next summer where... other indie bookstores and libraries can register a chapter locally. They'll get all the resources that they need and then begin having these same conversations because someone has to have these conversations with kids, and I hope that people everywhere can do it.
Yeah, and what a wonderful way to create access to information that you've already putting together with your expertise and then sharing that in a way that can have a bigger reach in more communities and more spaces.
Yep.
Impact more youth, which I think is amazing. So, Tondi, I just want to say thank you again for being here. Thank you for being part of this series. But I know I said it earlier, but most importantly, thank you for all you do for the youth in our community. And I'm really grateful for all of it. So if people want to connect with you and your work, where can they keep up with what you're doing?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't really have like a public persona.
We need someone to help you build a website or something.
Well, hopefully within the next year, there'll be a Good Trouble website.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll keep a lookout for that.
Okay.
So thanks again, Tondi.
Thank you.
So thank you for listening to Articulations, brought to you by the Margaret Slaw Center for Women and Gender Equity and KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM. Our interview is edited by Rosie Rowe. To round out the hour, we invite you to sit back and enjoy a selection of songs picked by Tondi. You can find the full Articulations playlist on Spotify or on the Slaw Center website.